I'm Brooke Gladstone with an OTM podcast extra. This one's about food, which turns out is shorthand for sustenance, sex, race, identity, you name it. I'm a typical Brooklynite, thus my native cuisine includes sushi, falafel, free-range pastrami, Singapore chow mai fun, and kale. My culinary experience is broad, but also shallow, oblivious to the profound personal and political implications of a person's cuisine. Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast, has been exploring identity, inequality, cultural appropriation, and grub in a special series he's calling Other People's Food. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, Brooke.
You're doing a special series called Other People's Food. And I understand you were pulled into this because of something that happened to you.
Partly that. I mean, I think our show in general has been going in sort of a direction of being more and more about obsessing about food to learn more about people. So I think this is sort of part of a natural progression. But yeah, we had an incident on the show a few months back where we were talking about the Korean dish bibimbap, which is like a mixed fried rice dish. And I had suggested a way that I thought bibimbap could be improved. And many people, including many Korean-American listeners, liked the suggestion a lot, but some did not. Some thought that it was offensive that I, a white guy who clearly was not well-versed in Korean food and culture, was suggesting that he knew better how to do something. Touched a nerve with some listeners, and Nick Cho, who is the Korean-American listener that I spoke with, he made an analogy. He said,
"Now with Korean food so trendy, it's cool, but it's also super awkward. It's sort of like my 90-year-old Korean grandmother suddenly becoming the hottest starlet in Hollywood. When people treat your cultural institutions so flippantly, that's where I think it can rub people like me the wrong way. It's a little bit like, here's your grandmother, here's how I could make her hotter."
Okay, so this tapped into what you discovered is a long simmering issue, so to speak, in the world of food. And one of the chefs that immediately jumped to your mind is Rick Bayless, who won Top Chef Masters. He owns a bunch of successful Mexican restaurants. When the president of Mexico came to the U.S. for a state dinner, the White House called on Bayless to cook the food. And he's a white guy from Oklahoma. And you asked him if he'd been criticized.
I know that there have been a number of people out there that have criticized me only because of my race, that because I'm white, I can't do anything with Mexican food. Okay, so you have to stop and say, wait, is that just plain racism then? I think that within 10 minutes into a conversation, I could share my passion for promoting what I think is the greatest cuisine on the planet, and that it doesn't come from a shallow understanding of it. It comes from a very deep understanding of it. I've done everything that I could to make it my own, and I just don't even understand where they're coming from.
He's sort of like the perfect test case for what happens when people cook other people's food, and especially what happens when a white chef gets rich and famous cooking food associated with people of color. On one hand, Rick Bayless has spent years traveling to Mexico, lived there for 5 years, is fluent in Spanish, is deeply immersed in the culture. This is not some sort of drive-by appropriation. He is...
Like you did with the Korean dish.
Perhaps. Although I didn't make any money off that. But yes, that is not an unfair parallel to draw. So he has put in all that work, and yet he still sometimes gets criticized. And that's what's really interesting, because we talk in this Sporkful to Professor Krishnendu Ray from the NYU Food Studies Department. He makes the point that when you have these kinds of translations, as he calls them, when you have a chef from outside of a culture, translates it for a new audience, something is gained and something is lost. You know, it's not an easy black or white issue.
What is gained in some ways is maybe subtlety, sophistication, because these are often skilled translators. You also lose some of the vernacular things that cannot be translated. I'm saying this with some amount of hesitation, because I think translation is a good and an interesting thing. I'm not opposed to it. But on the other side, all translations are also some kind of a loss.
Given all that, you asked Rick Bayless to react to charges that, you know, he was carpetbagging.
Do you think that at times in your career it has been to your advantage to be white?
I don't know the answer to that. I certainly have never thought about that. I mean, the fact that I could talk to people in a certain way, maybe that has been an advantage of mine. But still, I had to craft the words. It wasn't just because I was white that they would come to my restaurant, because restaurants fail at alarming rates. And to be a growing restaurant for 30 years says something that has to do a lot, I think, with the flavor of the food on the plate.
It's interesting. I'll be honest. I'm surprised that it's not something you had thought about. I feel like I personally have probably benefited at times in my life from being a white guy. You talk about being a translator of this cuisine. Don't you feel like to some degree you are a more familiar face when you're trying to sort of make it with a white audience?
Well, I've never tried to make it with a white audience. I have put everything together from nothing, basically, just like any other entrepreneur might have to do. If you look in our restaurant, it sort of looks like the population of the United States. It's not all white people.
So he didn't really want to acknowledge that being white was an advantage?
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised by that response. The way he then sort of segues quickly to talking about how he's sort of a self-made man, it came across as if he felt that if he acknowledged that being white was somehow an advantage, that it would undermine all of his success in his many decades as a celebrity chef and successful restaurateur. I don't think that it would. I think that you can acknowledge that you benefit from certain things without it meaning that you don't deserve any of your success.
So getting back to Nick Cho, the Korean-American who you spoke to after you suggested some improvements to an ethnic dish, and he said that it was particularly galling in general because when he was a kid, his school lunch isolated him.
I think that a lot of Asian-Americans have a similar story of bringing maybe last night's dinner leftovers into school the next day for lunch. And when you open your lunch, everyone kind of looking at it. Like when it's noodles, oh, those look like worms. Or if there's some kimchi that's in there, like what's that terrible smell? And even though that kid didn't mean it in terms of a cultural or racial ethnic sense, it stings as if it was.
This is something that we heard from numerous people we've been talking to. It's something that I had heard in bits and pieces before, but until I started working on this series, I don't think I understood exactly what an impact that has had on many children of immigrants, new immigrants. And I don't want to speak on behalf of all first-generation immigrants, but based on what I've heard and working on this series, a big part of their experience is sort of being constantly reminded in ways large and small, you are different. You're not one of us. You don't fit in here. And that's also something we heard from Nicole Taylor, an African-American cookbook author. She still has certain qualms about eating certain foods with certain people.
I can't tell you how many times people come up to me and say, where can I find the best fried chicken?
No.
Yes. I guess they ask me that because I'm from the South, and I'm like,
Really? Nicole, you think that's the only reason?
Well, I mean, why? Because I'm a black woman.
Maybe.
So you want me to keep it real? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Why do they keep asking me where the best fried chicken? I'm like, ask all these other people in New York that have been here forever. I don't know. I've only been here a year or so. And so my clever response would be in my kitchen.
And it isn't just that food serves as another way of stereotyping people. I found it was fascinating when Professor Ray told you how perceptions of food actually track with the perceptions of an ethnic group.
Yeah, this was something that really struck a chord with me. He talks about the foods we perceive as quote-unquote cheap ethnic food versus expensive foreign food.
Most Americans would hesitate to pay $30 for Chinese food, but they wouldn't bat an eyelid to pay hundreds of dollars. Sometimes over the last couple of years, the most expensive New York City restaurants have been Japanese restaurants.
Most of the Chinese people that we come into contact with are relatively impoverished, newer Chinese immigrants. Most of the Japanese people we come into contact with are business folks. We also have certain preconceptions of Japan as being a very affluent, westernized country and of China as being a country where there is more widespread poverty.
If a group of people are doing well and if a country is doing well economically, we tend to upgrade our estimation of their culture. That feeds back into whether we consider it cheap ethnic food or we consider it expensive foreign food.
But he also predicts that as Chinese immigrants move up the socioeconomic ladder in the U.S., that's going to change. And you're going to see more and more high-end Chinese restaurants opening up and more Americans being accustomed to spending more money for Chinese food.
So give me an example of a food that started out, you know, kind of low class and then got really classy.
Well, Italian food is probably the best example. I mean, generations ago, in the same way that we hear Nick Cho talking about being made fun of for bringing Korean food to school, Italian immigrants were made fun of for smelling like garlic. And their food was considered low class. In fact, public health specialists of the day warned that eating spicy food, which is what they thought of back then, spicy food meant a lot of garlic, would lead to cravings for alcohol. And it was only when the immigration of relatively impoverished Italians to America dried up and Italians moved up the socioeconomic ladder that we saw Italian food becoming a high-end thing. And then over time, it has continued to evolve. Now we have more awareness of Northern Italian food versus Southern Italian food. And I think that's sort of a delineation you're going to start to see with things like Indian food. We're going to start to learn more about the vast differences between different regions of Indian cuisine.
Well, in Chinese food, we know the difference between Hunan and Sichuan and so on?
I think we're starting to. I mean, there are so many Chinese restaurants in America. 90-something percent of them are all essentially serving the same menu. And so I think that the understanding of the different regions of China is still relatively limited, but I think you're right that it's changing and it's going to continue to change.
It's funny when you talk about Northern Italian food versus Southern Italian. Isn't the conventional wisdom that it's the Northern Italian cuisine that's the classy part and the Southern Italian that's still red with meatballs?
Yes. Most countries and regions have the area that they label as quote-unquote higher class and lower class, and there's always these sort of class resentments that go on between the different groups. There are stereotypes in the U.S. between the North and the South. And there's very interesting things happening in Southern cooking right now because the foods that most Americans associate with the South, Southern cooking, soul food, are traditionally Black foods. And as Southern food has become very de rigueur in recent years, there are a number of chefs that have risen to the national cream of the crop with them, and they've been predominantly white. And that has inflamed a lot of tensions, I think understandably so, because there are some very talented Black chefs with great pedigrees who aren't getting the same level of attention.
Isn't there something also limiting just about American mainstream food culture? I mean, we like a lot of sugar and a lot of fat.
One of the most interesting things that I've learned just working on this series is the way that you can follow a food's entry into the American food mainstream and the immigrants who brought that food, their entry into the American cultural mainstream, their assimilation. And the foods assimilate in the same way that a wave of immigrants assimilates.
Can you give me an example of that?
Well, the truth is that both are changed. So for instance, Americans eat a lot more spicy food now than we did 20 or 30 years ago. Largely because of an influx of newer waves of immigrants from Mexico and Latin America and from Asia and South Asia, where they eat more spicy food. I mean, 100 years ago, garlic was considered the spiciest thing anybody ate in America. Our palate is changing. The idea that sriracha would be so popular in America would have broken people's brains 30 years ago.
That's a hot sauce.
Yes, that's very spicy. And so these foods are entering the cultural mainstream of America. They're changing Americans' palates, and Americans are eating different foods as a result. But just as with immigrants assimilating in America, the foods themselves are also changed. A lot of the foods are made less spicy in order to appeal to Americans. So they're more spicy than what Americans were eating before, but less spicy than they were in the countries they came from.
This is so political. So all those people who are used to crumbling cornflakes over their mac and cheese are going to want to take their table back, not just their country.
But I think that one of the things that does give me some cause for optimism is, as Professor Ray says in the series, there is more opportunity for new foods to come in and change the culture. And in many other countries, the walls are much higher, so to speak, and there's a perception that this is our cuisine and it should never change. And American cuisine is constantly changing and evolving because we constantly have new waves of immigrants coming and influencing it. And that is exciting for people who want to eat new foods and learn more about other people's cultures.
Now for the media part.
Yes.
Is there a media strategy for getting a particular ethnic group's cuisine up on the charts?
Well, a cynical person would say step one is be white and speak English very well. But beyond that, your food needs to be typically sweeter and fattier than it's traditionally been prepared. And then there's also a certain amount of actual social media strategy. People taking photos of food is a huge thing on social media. And some foods just look better than others. You know, I'll give you a good example. Beef stew.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've cooked a pot of beef stew in your day.
Yeah.
Now, picture it in the pot. All you see is just a flat, brown liquid. I've tried to take pictures of my stews to share online, and I've never been able to take a good one. Because saucy dishes don't look good in a picture. Imagine now you take the same ingredients from that beef stew, but now you're going to put them on a bright white plate, and you're going to take big chunks of beef and put them in a little mound on the white plate. And you're going to take a little pile of cooked carrots, bright orange and beautiful. And then maybe a few potatoes next to that. And then you're going to drizzle the beef stew all over that food lightly. That's three-dimensional instead of flat. It's colorful instead of monochromatic. And so it looks a lot better. But the thing is that some cultures' foods have way more dishes like beef stew than others. And some of the chefs who take foods from other cultures and quote-unquote translate them for American audiences, that's one of the first things they do, is that they stand it up vertically on a plate in order to appeal to American audiences.
Is this discussion about how the role of food from other ethnicities trying to find their place in a mainstream white culture any different from the kinds of discussions we have about race and culture generally?
It's another way into the same conversation. Like, at the end of the day, it's about inequality and different cultures coming together and the slow and sometimes ugly process of us all learning about each other and learning to live together.
You'd think that food would have a more direct route in, because it's so intimate. And it's so delicious.
Well, I think in some ways maybe it does. I mean, you know, poll most Americans, how much do they really know about Chinese culture separate from food? Now, I understand that most Chinese restaurants are not serving traditional Chinese food, but to me, I feel like a superficial understanding of another culture is better than no understanding. Only through a superficial understanding can we get to a deeper understanding. So there are certainly cultures that I will be honest, I don't know much about beyond food, but at least I know that. And that gives me some feeling of common ground.
So that Korean dish, bibimbap, are you going to keep making it your way?
That's a good question.
Oh, come on. You know you will. You like it better the way you make it.
Well, I can't actually make it that way yet because I would actually have to engineer, especially design stone pot, and oh. I don't have the technology. But your basic question is like, will I continue to experiment with other people's food? the answer is yes, I will, but I will try to be more thoughtful about what I'm doing and how it could come across to other people. One of the lines that has been drawn in the conversation that I've had is, if you want to mess around in your own house, do whatever you want. If you want to eat other people's food and enjoy it, do whatever you want. The issue more comes about when someone puts themselves forward as an authority or a representative of a cuisine and then starts making money off of that cuisine. And the thing I learned about my messing around with Korean food is that I think of myself as a guy messing around in his kitchen. But the truth is, I have a food podcast. I have a web series on Cooking Channel. And so Nick and other people see me as someone putting himself forward as an authority. And so while I will continue to mess around in my own kitchen, I want to be more thoughtful about how it comes across when I'm doing things, quote unquote, in public in front of other people.
So you've done 3 episodes. You talk about the problem posed by celebrity Mexican chef Rick Bayless, the white Oklahoman, in the first episode. And then in the second episode, you talk about ethnic food stereotyping and the circuit a particular cuisine can travel as an ethnic group moves more into the center of mainstream American consciousness. And then the third one was interesting about one of the great civil rights activists who helped desegregate Southern lunch counters, which also offers some deep insight into apple pie. What else have you got?
We've got 2 more episodes coming, both taped live on stage just last week. They sort of tie a lot of the themes of the series together. One of them includes actress Rosie Perez talking really eloquently about her first trip to Puerto Rico and connecting to her culture through the food there.
I was like, this is me. This is me. All the tastes are familiar. The smells are familiar. And even the new foods just felt right to me. And I felt a part of things.
And then, of course, you end up with a little bit of music and comedy at the end.
Yeah, I mean, look, I was pleased that we managed to find the humor in some of these topics, too.
I know you can't find a real conclusion to this stuff, Dan, because it's just another facet, you know, in the diamond hard problem that America has with its melting pot culture.
What you're saying, Brooke, essentially is, did we fix everything? No, we did not fix everything.
Dan Pashman hosts the Sporkful podcast at WNYC Studios. Its current series is called Other People's Food, and you can get it at the Sporkful, wherever you get this podcast. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Brooke. In a minute,
and you've been listening to an On the Media podcast extra. If you like our podcast or you like our show, please go to iTunes and give us a review. It really helps us and makes us feel good. I'm Brooke Gladstone.